Hello, and welcome to SSP Weekly Podcast, where we dissect security and foreign policy stories from this week. I'm your host and co-director, Miriam Pasternak. Thank you for tuning in today. The theme of this week is U.S. nuclear deterrence strategy. A few weeks ago, a congressional report came out describing the strategic posture of the U.S., and in the weeks following its release, it has sparked a lot of debate of the future of U.S. deterrence strategy. With China as an emerging nuclear threat, the notion of tripolar deterrence, meaning a nuclear landscape consisting not only of the U.S. and Russia, but now also China, is at the center of U.S. nuclear strategy discussions. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing you to two guests. First, I sit down with Shane Ward, a fellow student here at Georgetown, and later with Dr. Adam Mount, senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists and one of the most important voices in the current debate on tripolar deterrence. He also is a PhD from our beloved university. But before I sat down with Dr. Mount, I wanted to know a bit more about traditional nuclear deterrence strategy from a student's perspective here at Georgetown, to understand what the general principles are and who the players are. So to kick us off, I sat down with Shane and had a conversation about traditional U.S. nuclear deterrence strategy. I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Miriam. It's a real pleasure to join the podcast this week. My name is Shane. I'm a first-year student in the Security Studies program here at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I'm originally from the UK, and I've been interested in and researching in the nuclear weapons space now for about 3 years here in DC as well as back in London.
We are very excited to have you on. Today, we are, of course, talking about U.S. nuclear deterrence strategy and how the recent commission report sort of summarizes the state of U.S. nuclear deterrence and also suggests some new efforts. So one of the things that the commission underlines is the importance of traditional nuclear deterrence. So my first question to you, Sean, is what is traditional nuclear deterrence strategy? And what fundamental principles govern it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think people tend to forget some of these principles because deterrence as a concept really stretches back to the end of the Second World War and even before, but particularly nuclear deterrence. You know, at its foundation, the goal of deterrence is to discourage an action through the fear of the consequences of that action. And this works particularly well with nuclear weapons for two main reasons. They have a uniquely destructive capability, first of all. There really is no conventional weapon that compares to a nuclear weapon. This fact alone really makes them, a formidable deterrent to have in one's arsenal. The other reason that's core to deterrence theory is that there really isn't a winner when it comes to nuclear war. It's very hard to win a nuclear war, particularly as multiple states developed a nuclear capability. It became very difficult for one state to, convincingly or convince themselves that they were able to, disarm the other enemy and therefore not face some sort of annihilation themselves. So even in a winning situation, you're likely to be hit with a nuclear weapon yourself. And so for those two reasons, nuclear deterrence has really worked since the end of the Second World War. They create this stalemate between states, which has, some would argue, eliminated great power war, the concerns for relative gains in international relations, arms racing. That certainly hasn't played out in totality, but it is one argument made by deterrence theorists, and that's why deterrence really continues as a fundamental feature of U.S. defense policy today.
So this fundamental principle of mutually assured destruction is, of course, a cornerstone in deterrence strategy. Has this changed from when it was established until today or even the 21st century? It sounds like something that when it's on the table, it sort of stops everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. So mutually assured destruction, really is the pillar of deterrence. And It itself didn't really emerge until several years into the Cold War. When the Soviet Union first developed a nuclear weapon, its capabilities were far behind the U.S., and so there wasn't really a credible mutually assured destruction wasn't really a feature then. You know, the Cold War arms race really stimulated the emergence of mutually assured destruction. And as Russia developed an arsenal comparable to the U.S. and then eventually greater than, this concept really came into being. For both sides, there was just no winner, as I said before. The likelihood that either could strike the other without facing immense retaliation was just nil. And so therefore, you know, many would argue there was no nuclear war.
And speaking of Russia having a larger arsenal than the U.S., often people speak about the amount of warheads, nuclear warheads, that each nation has. What's the best way of measuring nuclear capability when we compare the U.S. to its adversaries?
So both the U.S. and Russia particularly maintain a nuclear triad. So they have nuclear weapons that can be deployed on airborne bombers, submarines, on nuclear-powered submarines, and ICBMs, so missiles either in silos or mobile deployed missiles. And so typically we would count these purely as the number of warheads typically that are actually deployed by each country. Both sides has a significant portion of weapons that are deployed, and also many that are not deployed. They are awaiting testing, they are being decommissioned, things like that. So typically we're looking at weapons that are currently deployed, are ready to be used. There is only one treaty that still regulates that, the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START. And so that treaty will look purely at deployed weapons.
Mm-hmm. And that treaty, the New START Treaty, the United States and the Russian Federation have agreed to extend through 2026. But is China subject to a similar treaty?
So China is not. The New START Treaty, emerged through various previous treaties. So there was an original START Treaty. The New START was originally agreed back in 2010 and has been renewed continuously since. But China's reasoning for, and really the main reasoning that China is not a part of that, is China's arsenal is simply not comparable. For the U.S. and Russia, briefly, New START caps their number of deployed warheads at 1,550. China doesn't have that many warheads in its entire arsenal. And so the Chinese case has always been that it wouldn't be fair to be a part of arms control treaties when the numbers of weapons that they have is just simply not comparable to the U.S. and Russia.
So can you explain the difference between strategic and non-strategic nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so strategic, there isn't a real fine determined line between the two, but the differences between strategic and non-strategic, or sometimes called tactical nuclear weapons, can be broken down into a few categories. So tactical nuclear weapons typically have a lower yield. Low yield with the caveat that the yields of these weapons are still, typically many times more than our greatest conventional weapons, up to or more than the kilotonnage of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima. So lower yield than we're talking about with other weapons, but by no means low yield weapons. But in being low yield, they have this this tactical, this non-strategic purpose in that, they're able to be used for different deterrence missions. They haven't been used, but there is, concerns, particularly more recently with the war in Ukraine, that tactical nuclear weapons are more acceptable for use on the battlefield. Their targets are less likely to be cities or other hard military targets, but more, battlefield use, targeting softer military targets on the battlefield. So that's where the application comes in. They typically will have a shorter range as well. So they're more practical for that short range use. Going back to arms control, the challenge with tactical nuclear weapons is that none of the only arms control treaties still in existence today, New START, doesn't cover them. And so states, particularly Russia, have developed large arsenals of tactical nuclear weapons. The U.S. Maintains just about 100 B-61 bombs in Europe, which can be tactically used, hopefully not, but in the event of a conflict in Europe. But it's that flexibility of non-strategic nuclear weapons and the combination that they're not included in arms control agreements you know, that potentially is creeping into conversations we've heard in Russian rhetoric over the last year or two, that they might be acceptable to use, and that it might not be credible to respond with a strategic nuclear weapon to the use of a non-strategic nuclear weapon.
That's interesting. So the difference between strategic and non-strategic is actually important when we're talking about the treaties governing nuclear weapons. So when Putin is talking about the possible use of tactical nuclear weapons, we should still see that as a definite threat, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're very right. So in terms of the treaties governing these weapons, as I said, the New START treaty doesn't cover non-strategic and tactical nuclear weapons, and there really hasn't been any history of arms control treaties which do manage them, certainly not since shorter range treaties like the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. It is important with regards to the rhetoric as well. You know, any threat from Moscow to use a nuclear weapon should be treated as a serious one. If Russia feels in this conflict, and this was certainly part of the discussions towards the beginning when the war didn't look like it was going in the direction they had hoped. If Russia feels like it's being backed into a corner, or you know, potentially facing defeat, the use of one of these so-called lower yield weapons could be something they look to. And it's dangerous to use rhetoric that talks about these weapons as being lower yield and therefore more acceptable. Mm-hmm. They're still nuclear weapons, as I said. They still have massive destructive capabilities. And there's also a great risk that the use of one could escalate into the use of strategic nuclear weapons, which I don't think needs any more discussion about how destructive that could be.
Right. Part of the commission report is talking about the modernization needs when it comes to the U.S. nuclear arsenal. What is the current state, or what do we know about the current state of the U.S. nuclear arsenal?
So the U.S. is actually slightly decreasing the size of its nuclear arsenal right now. That shouldn't be taken to mean that they are working towards disarmament. But for example, the B-83, which is the largest weapon in the arsenal, is currently being phased out. The U.S. is also looking to modernize its nuclear arsenal, and phasing out some of these older weapons is a part of that. We see the U.S. moving towards a potentially slightly smaller, but certainly a more advanced and flexible deterrent. The U.S. really is upgrading all three legs of the triad. So the ICBM, the Minuteman III missiles, are being phased out and replaced, as are the bombers and the submarines. And so though the U.S. hasn't actually developed a brand new nuclear weapon since the end of the Cold War, they're certainly developing new variants. They're developing new delivery vehicles and capabilities. So the ICBMs, the submarines, and the bombers are all delivery vehicles. And so they're modernizing those aspects of the deterrent. These are programs which have been initiated a long time ago and are continuing. And we're seeing every year in the defense budgets that a considerable amount of money is being put towards these programs. The one thing I will say as well is that, though it hasn't yet fully gone through, the point about the U.S. developing a brand new nuclear weapon may potentially change. The W-93 warhead, which would replace some of the submarine-launched ballistic missile warheads, has started to be funded. It's potentially in the works, and if and when that eventually is deployed, would be the first new U.S. nuclear weapon since the end of the Cold War. And so there is some precedent there. Certainly the U.S. is looking to its adversaries, seeing what they're doing and looking to respond credibly.
Nuclear deterrence now is approaching 80 years of existence. And so I guess my final question is nuclear deterrence as effective today as it was or was intended to be?
Deterrence has been effective since the end of the Second World War, many would argue. There are certainly other factors that have contributed to the sort of long peace we've had since the end of the Second World War, whether that's economic interdependence, whether that's, the bipolar Cold War system, global democratization, and certainly a healthy dose of luck in avoiding, nuclear miscalculations and accidents. But ultimately, deterrence has worked to some extent. I don't think that's deniable. Today, I think deterrence is certainly facing, and we're seeing this in the modernization of not just nuclear arsenals, but also wider defense capabilities. It's facing up to a range of new challenges, both a litany of new actors So whether that's China looking to significantly increase the size of its arsenal, whether that's new nuclear, rogue states like North Korea developing capabilities. So that's one part of it. And also a litany of new, so-called emerging technologies, emerging threats that are really blurring the long-held red lines between, what is a credible attack to use a nuclear weapon in response to. Mm-hmm. So, is it credible to use a nuclear weapon in response to a cyber attack? How do we deter terrorists and non-state actors who, could feasibly get their hands on some kind of nuclear weapon? We talk about dirty bombs a lot. How do you respond and deter against that? How do you deal with these tactical nuclear weapons, these lower yield or flexible weapons, and their potential use in combat, as we talked about with Russia and Ukraine? And the nuclear powers have really been pretty ambiguous about those aspects. The US and the UK both have released statements in recent years that they would use nuclear weapons against some of those emerging technological threats. But there are risks in that. There really aren't the established long-held red lines. And so deterrence is facing, a real range of threats that are really important to think about and tackle quickly. If it's going to continue to keep peace and prevent war.
Right. Shane, I want to say thank you so much for being a guest here on the SSP Weekly. We really appreciate the insights that you could give me and us on nuclear deterrence strategy, both today and how it's evolved since the Cold War. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Miriam.
As you can hear, dear listeners, the strategy of nuclear deterrence is a complex and ever-evolving field. It's crucial for the U.S. to grasp the present landscape of threats and the capabilities of its nuclear opponents. As I mentioned earlier on, a recent bipartisan congressional report came out on October 12th, a little under a month ago. Among other things, the report suggests more nuclear buildup as necessary for an effective tripolar deterrent strategy. But is this the right approach to the complex reality of tripolar nuclear order? And which alternatives do we have? These are questions I discussed with Dr. Adam Mount, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists and a Georgetown PhD. But I'll let him introduce himself. Enjoy. Welcome so much to SSP Weekly, Dr. Mount. We're very happy to have you.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
My first question is whether you would like to just briefly introduce yourself.
Yeah. My name is Adam Mount. I'm a non-resident senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. I did a PhD at the Department of Government in Georgetown, so this podcast is near and dear to my heart. I work on North Korea, U.S. nuclear weapons policy, progressive foreign policy. A range of issues in there.
My first question is probably a little bit of a difficult one, but what makes tripolar deterrence so much more complex and difficult than traditional deterrence with an extra adversary added on?
It's a wonderful question. We really are in our infancy in thinking about deterrence between three nuclear powers. Most of our traditional deterrence theory was developed during the Cold War, which was a bipolar system. And starting about 4 years ago, the United States government started signaling credibly clearly that China's nuclear arsenal was starting to ramp up. And there were some very alarming projections that implied that they would, double then triple the size of their arsenal. And now we expect it to approach 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2035, which would mean that there are three nuclear powers with arsenals of comparable sizes. And then commander of U.S. Strategic Command, Admiral Charles Richard, really started to sound the alarm. He said that now the central challenge of U.S. strategic deterrence posture is to deter two nuclear-armed peer competitors at the same time who may coordinate with each other. So It's clear that this poses a challenge for the United States and for American strategists. We really are just starting a debate on how to respond and what our options are. But we also haven't really defined the problem clearly. It's not clear if China and Russia coordinate, how they would coordinate. It's not clear how far China's arsenal will grow. It's not clear to us what the range of our response options are and the constraints are on our ability to respond. So there's a sort of range of implications that we're just now starting to explore and uncover.
So the newly released report emphasizes the need for a nuclear posture capable of simultaneous deterrence, as it says. What does that mean exactly? Does that mean that we double up on warheads?
That is the question that we have to face. So one of the commissioners, Frank Miller, who has a long history at the center of the nuclear weapons debate, he was a former National Security Council staffer. He gave an interview in The Economist that said that we will have to double the size of our arsenal. He wasn't clear on what the specific number would be or why it would help us to do that. But in some ways, that's going to be the natural response, is to increase the size of the arsenal. Of course, it's not plausible that the United States would have a nuclear arsenal that's twice the size of Russia's. So the real kind of challenge in responding to tripolar deterrence is, how much do we need? What do we need it for? And is that sufficient to maintain stability and our national security interests? The way I like to think about it is, a valid answer to the challenge of tripolar deterrence is not a question of numbers or arithmetic. Mm-hmm. It really forces us to re-examine what U.S. nuclear weapons are for and how we deter an adversary. One of the remarkable things about the Strategic Posture Commission report is, though they hinted at a number of other aspects of U.S. strategic posture, their answer to the problem of tripolar deterrence was more nukes.
Yeah.
More nuclear weapons all across the board, new types, new numbers, deployed in new regions. And so their answer was primarily nuclear. Mm-hmm. I think the Biden administration and future studies will take a more holistic look at the range of options for responding.
So when Russia threatens or indirectly threatens with the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the war in Ukraine, how does that fit into this logic of the commission report?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, because there are kind of two overlapping problems of tripolar deterrence. One is at the strategic level. Mm-hmm. The number of aim points that U.S. strategic forces are going to have to hold at risk is going to roughly double. So you need a strategy to do that. At the same time, there's a problem of tripolar deterrence at the tactical level, at the non-strategic level, where you have to consider the risks of two simultaneous regional limited conflicts with nuclear armed adversaries that could involve limited nuclear use. And so there are some interdependencies and risks that could come from one nuclear adversary exploiting an opportunity created in another theater. So the Strategic Posture Commission proposed so many new types of nuclear weapons, in part because they were trying to propose nuclear answers to both problems at the same time. Mm.
In your article where you discussed the commission report, of course, you mentioned how a significant increase in U.S. nuclear capabilities might actually raise the risk of nuclear weapons being used. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Sure. There are two schools of thought on how deterrence works. One, which I think many commissioners of the Strategic Posture Commission share, is that if you enhance your margin of advantage, if you decrease the security of your adversaries, if your nuclear forces are more capable at holding at risk adversary nuclear forces, then you're more secure. Mm-hmm. More power means more security. The other school of thought thinks about deterrence in terms of stability, where you try to maintain an equilibrium of forces, acknowledge that your adversaries have secure second strike capabilities, that you're in a deterrence relationship, and that reduces the risk of nuclear use. Hmm. So my concern would be that a crash program to expand the size and the diversity of the U.S. nuclear force would have counterproductive effects. It would encourage our adversaries to arms race and create incentives for them to rely more on nuclear weapons and to adopt dangerous plans and procedures for command and control and escalation management that could lead to increased risk of nuclear use.
So following this school of thought that has to do with strategic stability, it sounds to me as if there's maybe more components. I'm thinking about new technologies, conventional forces. Is that correct?
It's become clear that strategic deterrence is no longer just nuclear deterrence. Mm-hmm. There's a range of new technologies that have strategic implications. This includes advanced long-range conventional strike options, including hypersonic strike. It includes cyber options that could undermine the reliability of a country's nuclear forces. There's a range of these technologies that affect strategic stability that are not just nuclear. And one failing, I think, of the Strategic Posture Commission report is that it didn't fully account for the range of those disruptive technologies.
Mm-hmm. That leads me to my next question, which has to do with whether you think there are any notable omissions or topics that the commission sort of fails to illuminate or mention.
The central failure, I think, was that it doesn't propose a strategy for how to meet the challenge of tripolar deterrence. The title of the article is a Not-So-Strategic Posture Commission.
Right.
Because the commission says that we need to have additional forces in order to enact overwhelming damage to continue to maintain deterrence. But it doesn't explain how much damage is required against what kinds of targets and how many U.S. warheads of what types are needed to inflict that damage. So because it doesn't depend on a strategy, their answer is an across-the-board increase. More of this, more numbers, more types, more promptness, more deployment. And they can't explain how much.
But how would you expect a commission to be able to say precisely how much damage? Isn't it hard to determine like a specific amount of damage that we could endure? I don't know. I'm trying to play devil's advocate, maybe.
It's a wonderful question because it's extremely difficult because you have to be operating off a theory of what your adversary values and how much is sufficient to deter various different types of attack.
Yeah.
Knowing that with any kind of quantitative certainty is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you're not working off a strategy, you're just building things haphazardly.
Yeah.
So this is why I say that answering the challenge of tripolar deterrence requires us to reconsider what U.S. nuclear weapons are for. Mm-hmm. Logically, you can't have the same strategy and hold twice the number of targets at risk with the same number of warheads. Mm. Something has to give. And in the Strategic Posture Commission's view, it's the size of the arsenal. In my view, it's much more plausible and I think much more effective if we reinterpret and reconsider the strategy component.
So what other variables could be interesting to look at? Instead of amount of warheads or size of arsenal, what would be interesting, in your opinion, to build a strategy of?
There are many variables that could help us to reconsider American nuclear strategy to find an effective answer to tripolar deterrence. The central question is damage limitation still the central mission of U.S. nuclear forces? We don't target cities, we don't target civilians, so we do counterforce. And so the question is our strategy preemptive counterforce to limit damage from an adversary's first strike? Is it retaliatory counterforce to strike an adversary's nuclear forces after they've launched a first strike? In both cases, if the answer is yes, we're trying to limit damage, that drives up the number of warheads because mm-hmm. you're trying to hold very secure, mobile, or hardened targets at risk. And there are many of them. So the central question is, are we trying to limit damage? Is that a feasible objective? In what contingencies? And how much damage do we want to limit? Once you answer that question, then there are a number of smaller variables that you can adjust. How much reliability do you need from your nuclear forces? How much damage do you expect on particular types of targets? Mm-hmm. Determines how many warheads you need to program against those targets, and so on. There are a number of variables that have quantitative answers that the president doesn't normally issue guidance on, mm-hmm. because they're too technical and they're normally left to STRATCOM and the services to determine. But if the president isn't issuing guidance on these kinds of questions, it's unlikely we get to a coherent strategy on tripolar deterrence.
If you were looking at this from, let's say, a Chinese perspective, if you were sitting in the seat of a Chinese official thinking about nuclear deterrence strategy, looking at the US and Russia the last 70 years, what do you think your reaction to this commission report would be?
One of the challenges for this debate is Americans don't know how Xi Jinping thinks about his nuclear forces. It's clear that something has changed diametrically in how China thinks about its nuclear forces within the last decade. Mm-hmm. We're not altogether certain exactly what changed. I suspect that if you're reading the Strategic Posture Commission report in Beijing, you're not very surprised.
Right.
It's confirmation that the US relies on its nuclear forces, that it wants to limit damage from its adversaries, that it's uncomfortable mm-hmm. being in a mutual vulnerability relationship with adversaries. And it's confirmation that the US has options to increase the size of its arsenal. And if you're looking at it from Beijing, that's a reason to continue to build. The other reason why I think the Strategic Posture Commission is not surprising to Beijing is that it accepts the logic of escalation control. And for years, China has had this no first use policy, which in some ways is the most restrictive declaratory policy of any nation in the world. And they haven't revised it, they haven't weakened it. Mm-hmm. But the growth of their arsenal does raise serious questions about whether they mean it, whether the meaning of that is changing, and whether they'll revise that statement in the future. Because the US government says that China's building low-yield nuclear warheads and additional non-strategic options. And that implies that one of the things that has changed about China's strategic culture is how it thinks about the utility of nuclear weapons in limited conflict. Hmm.
Do you think that it also is a recognition of a rapidly changing landscape in the world of nuclear weapons, and that new technologies is sort of blurring the threat landscape? Do you think that's part of the reason?
Yes, there's much that's changing on the strategic landscape. We're really in a time of flux for strategic stability. Mm-hmm. Each country is now deploying new generations of nuclear systems that in some cases are increasingly capable. And each country is now developing and deploying new non-strategic systems, which has implications for the stability of theater conflicts and the risk of limited nuclear use. Added to that, there's a range of conventional and non-kinetic capabilities that have bearing on strategic stability. And at the same time, you're seeing pretty dramatic shifts and pretty rapid shifts in the balance of forces in the Western Pacific, in Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. that have strong implications for how these countries think about deterring aggression and their interests in a limited conflict.
If you had been in that commission, what would you have pushed, or what do you see as sort of the next logical step after these recommendations?
I think the Strategic Posture Commission report is a valuable and I think a landmark entry into what should be a much broader debate on how to respond to the challenge of tripolar deterrence. Frankly, this is going to be the default answer for virtually all Republicans and even most Democrats. It is incumbent upon experts and analysts and Congress members and the Biden administration to take a more quantitative and more considered approach to the challenge and present alternative views.
That actually concludes my list of questions, Dr. Mount. I want to say thank you so much for being a guest here on the SSP Weekly.
My pleasure. It's a great format, and I look forward to listening in the future.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversations about nuclear deterrence strategies. As the Commission report stated itself, nuclear deterrence is today as important as ever. I want to say thank you to Sean and to Dr. Mount for participating in today's episode. Next week, Gareth will be back, and we will have two new stories for you on Friday. Until then, have a great weekend, everybody.